This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The election of Donald Trump has provoked many declarations of apocalypse among progressives who see his unhinged extremist right-wing and Nazi-sympathizing ideology as an existential threat to our democracy. During Barack Obama's presidency, many on the fringes of the right wing had similar reactions. Historian and educator and author Betsy Hartman has written a new book that explores the peculiarly American disposition for apocalyptic thinking. That fatalism that is dominant in U.S. culture is firmly rooted in the origin and history of the nation, going back to the Puritans of New England. Betsy Hartman is the author of the feminist classic Reproductive Rights and Wrongs, The Global Politics of Population Control. She's written several other books, including A Quiet Violence, View from a Bangladesh Village, and is the co-editor of the anthology Making Threats, Biofears, and Environmental Anxieties. She's also a professor emerita of development studies and senior policy analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. And she now joins me to discuss her newest book, The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. Welcome to the program, Betsy.
Thank you so much.
So let's first talk about what you mean by the America Syndrome and why apocalyptic thinking is so dominant. In your book, you identify these sort of seven markers of apocalyptic thinking that are kind of hallmarks of this America Syndrome. Could you go through these to start us out?
Yes. I identify them as the seven deadly synergies, starting with American exceptionalism, the idea that we are a special and chosen people meant to guide the world. Secondly, this belief in apocalyptic thinking, the tendency to think either the end of the world is nigh or we're on the verge of a new millennium, a new Jerusalem, deriving from Christianity, but permeating the culture and secular culture as well. A third thing is our tendency towards being too susceptible to sermonizing, especially a form of sermon that the Puritans mastered called the Jeremiad. And in the Jeremiad, these were political sermons given by the Puritans on special days like election days, in which they told their congregations that and the people in the town that they were sinful and God was punishing them for their sinful ways. But if they could redeem themselves and follow their leaders and follow the chosen path, they could once again get on the road to virtue and lead the world. America could lead the world into a new Christian millennium. And you see the echoes of this Jeremiad in speeches on the right and left, that only if we could, you know, cure ourselves of our sins, redeem ourselves, then we will be great again or pure again. America Syndrome also includes a tendency towards empire. In fact, it's formative. The idea that this land is our land, not the land of the Native Americans, not the land of the Mexicans who lived here before, that we are justified in colonizing the continent, and then, of course, justified in dominating the world. So empire is very much part of it. Because we are a chosen people, we deserve this. We are the best, and it's kind of part of this Anglo-Saxon virtue. And related to that is, you know, exclusion of those who don't measure up, to the white Protestant ideal, male ideal, I should say, anybody who's deviates from that ideal. And, you know, if you're not chosen and you're part of the unchosen, you're to be looked down upon, you're to be feared, you're to be banished. Also, a sense of kind of paranoia and anxiety that for those of us who are supposedly chosen or for the chosen people, we can never really be good enough. The Puritans left us this legacy that Puritans didn't know until they died, supposedly, whether they were going to go to heaven or hell. It was predestined. So you could live like the most virtuous life or religious life, and you still didn't know if God had chosen you for heaven or hell. And there's this sense that we can never be pure enough. We can never be good enough to justify our special mission and place in the world. This all kind of affects our view of nature, and I call it nature is a fractured mirror. So nature is either a wilderness to be conquered or a wilderness to be saved. It reflects our unsettled feelings about ourselves and who we are in the world, and we project those onto nature. Lastly, too, there is a tendency towards dualism, either or ism, which goes along with the exclusion you're either good or you're bad. We tend to see things in black and white terms, which is quite problematic. And all through these seven deadly synergies, you have kind of this apocalyptic mindset that joins them together in a way. It's part of a larger fabric. Right. It's not the only part of the syndrome, but it's a major part.
And so these seven deadly synergies, I love that that term for them, define this America syndrome that you describe in your book. And so much of what you're saying, as you were going through them, of course, I'm thinking about the political moment that we're living in right now, where so many of these things become apparent. So let's go back in history. You're a historian. This book really does go all the way back to history. You start out talking about the Puritans, Pride and Prejudices of a Chosen People. When we think of the Puritans, and there's a lot of sort of myths about who they were and what they represented. We think of, stodgy, stoic, conservative, close-minded people who were escaping oppression. But who were the Puritans really, and how did their ideology establish this apocalypticism?
Right. Well, the Puritans who settled in New England, the first settlers who came, of course, they were religiously oppressed partly because they believed they were the chosen people. They had their kind of pure community, and they didn't want to kind of compromise with other religious factions. So in a way, they came to the New World to make their own world, to make their own community. And it wasn't so much escaping oppression as embracing their kind of mission. So that's one thing. Second thing is that we tend to think of the Puritans very much as these dour little men and women, and the men in their little black hats and the women with their high white collars. But in the Great Migration that happened after the initial Puritans came to Plymouth Rock, when more and more Puritans came over actually from the UK, you have, it's a mixed bunch of people. Rich people dress very nicely and in colorful clothes. So I think we need to get away from this kind of idea that everybody's the same and there are all these dour little people running around. It was a complex society. And we have to look at also who were the leaders of the Puritans, what was the relationship to wealth and power, and that there were different strands within the religion, but still very much part of the belief system. And I mentioned this in the Deadly Synergies, is the idea that you didn't know whether you were going to go to heaven or hell until you died, predestination, Calvinism. But combined with that was this idea that we were going to be the city, they were going to be the city on the hill when they came to New England, especially the first Great Migration, that they were going to establish a perfect society that would lead the way to Christendom all over the world. So kind of overblown sense of mission. And then whenever that mission started to fail, then for example, in relations with the Native Americans, you see the kind of resurrection both of a kind of violent reaction and empire reaction. This is our land. The Native Americans don't belong here, you know, and one Puritan leader said it was really good that many Native Americans had died of smallpox and other diseases before they arrived because they had vacated the land for them. So you have that tendency, and you also have a tendency toward apocalyptic thinking. If things are going wrong, then, you know, maybe the end of the world is approaching, and we need to make them go right. So they were always reading kind of in problems and challenges that perhaps the end of the world was nigh.
Now, it's not just sort of conservatism that has been prone to apocalyptic thinking, right? And, one of the more recent histories in the United States is that of the fear of nuclear war, which is now sadly back on the political landscape. But you also write about how the fear over nuclear war wiping us all out, and that fatalistic thinking about it is part of the story. And today, on the among those people who understand that climate change is a real thing, we have a strong tendency toward apocalyptic thinking as well. Should that all be seen as part of this America syndrome? I mean, aren't people in other countries also worried that climate change will wipe us out and nuclear war will wipe us out? Or is it uniquely an American fear?
Well, it's probably not uniquely an American fear, but I think Americans fear it more than many other people. And, when you study how people are reacting to climate change in other countries, it's often in very practical manners trying to affect the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, trying to adapt landscapes. In many developing countries, people are trying to adapt agriculture to greater possibility of drought and storms, so that climate change is real, it's urgent, people are absolutely concerned about it in many places, and here in the United States too. But then how do we respond to it? Is it really going to be the end of the world, or do we just get busy with, mitigating carbon emissions and adapting to the climate changes that have already happened? So it's partly, I think, in a way, we should be entering the age of the practical instead of the age of the apocalyptic, because there is so much to be done, practically and politically, of course, to respond to climate change. And I partly wrote this book because I myself have been very apocalyptic, and I'm of the generation that grew up during the Cold War, very much scared of nuclear weapons. And I talk about this in the book and how it had a profound impact on me as a child and also as a young adult. And I think my generation in particular carries many of those fears with us. And of course, they're being resurrected today, as you say, with Trump and North Korea. It's so easy, really, to trigger those apocalyptic fears when we feel there's a global challenge, for example, like climate change. And I think we need to fight against that apocalyptic tendency. I think another reason in climate change field why these apocalyptic fears arise and why they're so American is we live in a country where the leadership presently, and of course many people, fossil fuel industry, has worked hard to try to convince people that climate change is not real, to deny climate change. And so we're stuck in this either-or situation. You have the deniers on the one hand, climate change isn't real, like Trump, and you have people then who its situation gets worse when you don't do anything about it, get increasingly apocalyptic or appeal to apocalyptic fears to try to get the population to do something about climate change. So there's kind of a mad tango between the climate denialists and the climate apocalyptics. I think we need to break through that.
Can apocalyptic thinking be used to fuel positive action? I mean, before we take action, we need awareness. Awareness can lead to fear, but sometimes fear can lead to action. Or does apocalyptic thinking actually paralyze us?
Yeah, but it's tricky, right? Because there's such a fine line between urgency it's absolutely urgent that we address climate change right now and, you know, affect a rapid transition from fossil fuels. Does that mean, though, that it's the end of the world? So we tread a fine line here, and I think we need to broaden public discourse in the United States so people can understand there are different, you know, it's more complex. There are different options here, and that we don't need apocalyptic messaging all the time to try to get people politically engaged. And in fact, I think apocalyptic messaging, you know, it might have a short-term response of getting people interested in the subject, but in the long term, it tends to make people feel fatalistic. And that they're, you know, they can't do anything. So it carries a lot of baggage with it. I'm watching right now, too. You know, it's very easy to get apocalyptic about Trump, you know, and I confess I periodically do myself. But
I do, too.
If we think of Trump as the Antichrist, then other presidents before him, you know, like George Bush Jr. in the Iraq War, suddenly start looking good in comparison. And I don't think he was good in comparison. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that we need to look historically. The trouble with apocalyptic thinking, too, it breaks kind of a historical analysis and a political economy analysis. It kind of encourages us not to do that when that is the way we need to study things deeply, causes and effects, history-wise, economic-wise, political-wise, in order to understand our present state of affairs.
Your book is entitled The America Syndrome, Apocalypse War and Our Call to Greatness. I want to focus finally on the call to greatness part of it, because so much of American thinking and culture is embedded in this assumption that of American exceptionalism, that America is this great city on the hill, as you started out discussing, that you know, we are this leader historically and globally in our democracy and our constitution, kind of erasing the horrors of the genocide of Native Americans and the institution of slavery to our detriment. I mean, today we're having these violent battles over Confederate statues because we've never come to terms with the fact that our greatness, supposed greatness, is rooted in, you know, massive violence. So how important is it to tackle that?
Very important indeed. And I, you know, I hope that's the message of the book, that we really need to understand, you know, there are some good things about the United States system, like the separation of powers, but we have to acknowledge that we're not great, and we're certainly not the greatest of all, that our history is bloody and violent and built on exclusion and violence against people who are considered outside of the chosen people. So, also, I try in the book to show how much militarism infects our kind of worldview, that we are the greatest military power on earth. What does that mean? This idea that we're the world redeemer, that we make the world safer democracy. What has that done to the world and to our own country, basing our greatness on military might? And I think it's only getting worse. So we need to really become less provincial, for one thing, and to recognize that all countries in the world have good things and bad things about them, including our own, that we're not the greatest country, no country is the greatest country, that we can look to others to learn lessons on how to do things, that more diplomacy and less militarism is absolutely essential to have world peace and to make a world where, you know, globally we can work together on things like climate change. So we absolutely need to get over American exceptionalism, American greatness, this idea that we are the greatest. And, you know, our politicians are always appealing to it, both Trump and Hillary Clinton, for example, in the last campaign. And I think if we could acknowledge that we are a country like any other country, and that we have a deep, complicated, and violent history, and we need to understand that, then we can start moving forward to build a better country.
Betsy Hartman, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for all the work that you've done. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Betsy Hartman is a historian, educator, women's rights advocate, and author of the feminist classic Reproductive Rights and Wrongs, The Global Politics of Population Control. She's also a professor emerita of development studies and a senior policy analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. We've been discussing her newest book, The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.